So when we talk about worldviews and conflict, there's a Bible passage that's really, really important to us. It's in Colossians 2:8. And this verse is kind of like a theme verse when we're talking about worldviews and we're talking about ideas and we're talking about what is true and what is not and what we believe and what we shouldn't believe. And it's a very clear command, a warning from Paul to the Colossian church. And he says to them, see to it that no one takes you captive. See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophies. See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophies. And Paul tells you why. Because these philosophies are based on basic human traditions and not on Christ. And what Paul is telling us in this passage is that the basic principles of these world, the basic traditions of these world are can or cannot, may or may not be in accordance with what God has said, but you should not be taken captive by anything that's not based on what God said. I'll repeat that. The way of this world, the wisdom of this world, the traditions and the basic principle of this world, they may or may not line up with what God says. They may or may not agree with what God says. But we are never to be taken captive by an ideology, a philosophy that is contrary to what God says. In other words, God's wisdom supersedes human wisdom. I think we're all in agreement here. I'm preaching to the choir because we're all Christians. God's wisdom far supersedes human wisdom. So for us to choose human wisdom when it is in opposition to God's wisdom is foolish. And that's what Paul is saying. Don't be taken captive. Don't let yourself be fooled. Don't let yourself be captured by these ideas. So how do worldviews affect us? Some people may say, I don't have a worldview. I don't have a worldview. They claim to see the world the way it really is without needing God to help them understand it. You know what? I see things clearly. I don't need religion. You'll hear that from many people. I don't need religion. I don't need Christ. I don't need a Bible. I can understand the world the way it is. Perfectly fine. The problem is that seeing is not just done with your eyes. Seeing is done with your mind. You don't just see with your eyes. You see with your mind. And the way that works is that your worldview influences what you see. There's a key principle here that I want you to take with you tonight, and that is what you see is influenced by what you've been taught and by what you are already expecting to see. Because your mind filters all of the data that comes into you based on what your mind already understands. That's why Paul also says to the Corinthians that part of our job is to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And what Paul is, if you read the context of that passage, what Paul is telling us is that we need to have Christ-mindedness, the mind of Christ, so that when we see things, we see them with Christ's mind. We process them with what Christ has established and determined and the truths that we know from Christ. And that's why it's important, again, in Romans in chapter 12, that we have to renew our minds and not conform to the mind of this world, but transform our minds to the mind of Christ. Again, why? Because you don't see with your eyes. You see with your mind. And the problem is that the ideas that you have consequences. Your ideas have consequences. I want to show you a video, so we need audio here. Victor, I'm going to show you a video that captures this idea about how ideas have consequences. It's a short video, but I want you to watch it. And right before the video, the battle for the hearts and the minds. Somebody says that this whole battle of ideas is like a second great civil war. And where are the battlefields of this war that we're fighting now? It's the minds and the hearts of young people. That's the battlefield. There's one sector or many sectors that want to have access to your mind and to put their input into your mind and their ideas into your mind and shape your mind. Competing forces want to shape the minds of today's youth. And it's a battlefield. And only those that come with God's truth are going to do you any good. The rest are going to create havoc in your mind because of this. Because Proverbs says that as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. So what is a worldview? A way of viewing or interpreting all of reality. A worldview is a way of viewing or interpreting all of reality. Everything in the world we see through this filter, okay? It's a filter through which everything that enters our mind must go through. Think about a pair of glasses. That's what a worldview is. And I've illustrated this to you before, but I think it's so, so powerful of an illustration that we need to remember it, memorize it. We could use it when we're sharing with other people about this. Worldviews are like tinted glasses. So if you're born in New Delhi and you're a Hindu, let's say for argument's sake that your lenses are tinted yellow. They're yellow lenses. So as you put on your lenses, as you grow up, as you're taught Hinduism and the Hindu way of life, in a Hindu culture, everything is tainted yellow because that's the worldview of Hinduism. So you may look at a wall that's white, but to you, what is white? White is like a yellowish tint because that's the way you've always seen it. That's your worldview. Everything is seen through that eyes, but not everybody's born in New Delhi. Okay, you may have been born in Tibet, or you may have been born in Hong Kong, or you may have been born in another part of the world where you're a Buddhist. Buddhist parents, Buddhist upbringing. So let's say for argument's sake that then your lenses are blue. So when you grow up and as you grow up, you see everything blue because that's the way your parents brought you up. That's what you've always heard. You see relationships through a Buddhist worldview. You see finances through a Buddhist worldview. You see life and happiness and philosophy, everything through a Buddhist worldview. And that white wall, to you, it looks kind of bluish. That's what white looks like to you because you've always seen it bluish. Buddhistly, if you wanted to say that's not a word, but that's the idea. So let's say you're not born there. Let's say you're born in Islamabad. So you're a Muslim. And you're born into a Muslim family or Afghanistan or Pakistan or any of these countries. And so your lenses, let's call them red, okay? So for argument's sake, you see everything red from the time you're born. Same thing. You see relationships through a Muslim perspective. You see finances and economy through a Muslim perspective. Everything has that red tint. Everything. And you see that white wall, but white always to you has been kind of reddish because that's the tint of your lens. You see where we're going. Every worldview has a different color. And Christianity is not an exception. Let's say you're born in the United States. Well, let's say your lenses then are kind of like greenish, just for argument's sake. And you see everything in this as an American, as a Christian American, greenish. Relationships, everything else. So how do you escape? How do you escape this? Which worldview is right? Imagine you put a Hindu with his tint, you know, yellow tints, and a Muslim with his red tints, and they're arguing about the color of that white wall. Are they ever going to come to an agreement? No. Because to the Hindu, it's obviously yellow, and to the Muslim, it's obviously red. So what's wrong with this guy? Why can't he see it so clearly like I see it? And they're never going to get to an agreement. So what is the solution? What is the solution? How do we solve this dilemma? Are we, as you will learn if you take a class in modern, you know, contemporary religion or religion analysis class or philosophy of religion class, what you're going to be taught is that there is no solution. Everybody's view is equally valid because everybody was raised with this view, and who am I to say that you're wrong or right? Everybody's tint is different, and nobody can escape their own bias, so everybody's right. That's what you'll learn. But that's not the solution. What's the solution to this analogy? What's that? Somebody's in? Well, everybody has glasses, but the best next best thing you can do is what? No. Clear lenses, right? So if you take off your yellow lenses and you put on clear lenses, guess what? Everything now looks like it really is. The only way you can get those clear lenses is you got to get it from somebody that is not subject to all of the biases that we're subject to. Who transcends us and all of our biases? God, the creator of the whole universe. That's why when God gives us in his word the way things really are, he's given us that clear lens. So when you embrace a Christian worldview, what you're doing is you're putting on those clear lenses so that now you can see everything the way God sees it. And you know what? That's when things begin to make sense. That's when things begin to make sense. So what is the right worldview? God's worldview. So when we say Christianity, I may have thrown you off when I told you Christianity is also subject to those lenses. It's because Christianity is a very general, vague term, unfortunately, in our society. And there's so many people that fall under that umbrella of Christianity that don't really see things God's way, and that have been raised with traditions and all kinds of ideas that are not God's ideas, that we need to put religion aside and say, okay, Christians that follow God's word, those are the ones that are wearing the clear lenses. So the lenses, the clear lenses are God's mind, God's way of seeing things. So in that competition, in that battle for ideology, now I hope we get a clear picture of what a worldview is from this analogy. Now we'll watch that video. Major worldviews. Where's my video? Sorry about that. Give me a second. Here it was. I skipped it. Now we're going to watch the video.
The happiness of the creature consists in rejoicing in God. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky. In the survival of favored individuals and races during the constantly recurrent struggle for existence, we see a powerful and ever-acting form of selection.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with inherent and inalienable rights.
Faith is to believe what you do not see. The reward of this faith is to see what you believe.
Faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence.
From God, and through God,
and to God are all things.
God is dead, God remains dead, and we have killed him.
If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
It's all these ideologies that so permeate our society and that we're getting bombarded with on every side. That's the battle that we just talked about, and that's world. So what are the major worldviews? There are so many that rather than focus on religion and look at the Hindus and the Muslims and the Buddhists, and some one day we'll break those down one by one and consider what they believe and why it doesn't stand up, why the lenses are not clear. What I want to focus today is on the ideas, not the religions, the ideas that are a part of our culture, of our society. Whether you're in school or not, wherever you are, if you turn on the TV, if you go watch a movie, if you listen to whatever you do in our culture, you're going to be exposed to these ideas, especially if you're a student or have been a student. Okay? So an important principle is learned from Paul. Paul said that I have fought the good fight, I finished the race, and I've kept the faith. Paul says, look, I fought this battle and nobody was able to take my faith from me. I kept my faith. What is he saying? He's saying nobody took me captive with their hollow and deceptive philosophies. Remember, he wrote that. What's he saying? Nobody took me captive with these hollows and deceptive philosophies. I kept my faith. But in order to do that, we must be able to, one, understand our worldview. And that's what we do all the time in church. We talk about Christianity, the Bible, what we believe, what God teaches, etc. But you also have to understand their worldview. You have to understand your enemy. You have to understand where he's coming from. You have to understand the flaws, the fatal flaws in these ideas that are constantly bombarding us. And that's how you know how to defend your position. So let's start with naturalism. The cosmos is all there is, ever was, ever will be. Naturalism is so pervasive in our society. If you think about it, naturalism is what runs our whole science our whole science world is run by naturalism. And we bash it a lot, but there's actually a lot that you can do through a naturalist perspective. When you look at nature and you try to understand nature and the laws of nature and how they work, you're going to discover great things like we have discovered. You're going to apply some of those laws and create and invent things. It's a powerful thing. But what's naturalism's fatal flaw? Naturalism is the idea that the only thing that exists is the natural world. There is nothing supernatural. That's what naturalism is. No supernatural. Nothing transcends the natural world. Everything boils down to chemistry. Everything. In other words, what are some of the supernatural or non-material things that don't exist? God, heaven, hell, angels, demons. But beyond that, you don't have a mind. The mind is just another word for an organ called brain. So there is no immaterial mind. You don't have a soul. A soul is something immaterial. You don't have a soul. What everybody calls a soul, that's also your brain. Ideas, they're not really out there. Ideas are chemical reactions in your brain. So everything has to be reduced. It's a form of reductionism. Everything has to be reduced to natural stuff. And whenever you're going to investigate something, by definition, God cannot be the answer because he's supernatural. And nothing supernatural is allowed in naturalism. So I was explaining to a group of students just this past week that I spoke to at a school, and I was telling them about 700 students, and I said to them, look, here's the problem with naturalism, okay? Here's the problem, and this analogy really works well. Naturalism will tell you, okay, we have a problem to solve. And the problem we have to solve is 2 + 2. But you can figure out whatever answer is going to work, except you can't answer 4. Because 4 is not allowed. What's going to happen? What is that going to produce? When you try to answer that question, that ultimate question, and you're not allowed to answer with the right answer, then you're going to come up with all kinds of crazy answers. And they're all going to be wrong. So by default, naturalism says you can't say God, you can't answer God. God is not the answer to anything because God doesn't exist. So any answer except God. So where did life come from? Well, it wasn't God. We don't know, but it wasn't God. Well, not allowed. Then you get answers like aliens, like I've shown you before. Well, life on Earth was seeded by aliens. That's acceptable because aliens are natural things. They're material things. We haven't seen any. We don't know about them. We have no idea. They're only an idea in our head, but you know what? They would fall under the category of natural. So, but you see what happens. Or the universe. Where did the universe come from? Well, it came from nothing. Like we've gone over that conversation. And you have to come up with answers like that because you cannot give the right answer. The right answer is God as the agent that created it. So naturalism is fatally flawed. And we're going to see a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But that's what we're up against. And so you walk into a college classroom in any of the sciences, biology, chemistry, you know, physics, any of the classes, and what you're going to get is pure, unadulterated naturalism. Natural. The natural world is all that is. No God, nothing supernatural, nothing except God. So what's the next worldview that is competing for the minds of our young people? In the science department, it's naturalism. And then in the ethics department, it's called hedonism. That's the mentality, the idea that permeates in our society. And what is hedonism? It's the pursuit of pleasure is the ultimate good. What determines if something's right or wrong? Well, is it pleasurable? If I enjoy it, it's right. And if I don't enjoy it, it's wrong. And guess what? Since enjoyment is such a personal thing, then everybody decides what's right and wrong for themselves. Hedonism goes right in hand with relativism. We all decide for ourselves what's right and wrong because it's all based on pleasure. And so it's that mentality that the greatest pursuit, the greatest thing you can dedicate your life to is pursuing pleasure. And the mentality, again, ties right in with naturalism. If naturalism is true, listen carefully. If naturalism is true and there is no heaven and no hell and nothing else, what happens when you die? It's all over. That's it. So the only chance you have of any pleasure is going to be in this life. So make the most of it. Go for it. Don't waste any opportunity to feel pleasure, because when you die, that's it. It's all over. So there are consequences to a naturalism way of viewing life, and in ethics and morality, those consequences are disastrous. Disastrous. And then you have people who will deny God not for any philosophical reason, and they won't deny God's existence for a scientific reason. They won't even do it for an emotional reason. You know why they deny God's existence? For moral reasons. And they'll be right. I can give you quote after quote after quote by these guys. And here's what they say. I don't believe there's a God because I don't want there to be a God. Because if there's a God, then I have to adhere to certain rules. There's somebody I'm accountable to, and there's somebody telling me what's right and wrong. And I don't want that in my life, so I don't believe in God. So that is hedonism. It's the pursuit of pleasure. Now, hedonism is also fatally flawed. It doesn't work. And I'll show you one example how hedonism doesn't work. If the greatest thing you can do is the pursuit of pleasure, what if my idea of pleasure is hurting you? Guess what? It's perfectly okay, because by the rules of hedonism, by the mentality that the pursuit of pleasure is the greatest good, then I'm pursuing my greatest good. And there are psychopaths, that's the way they think. Hurting people brings them joy. So they hurt people. See, that's the problem. And then you're stuck in a conundrum, because you can't tell them they're wrong. Because how could you tell them they're wrong if they derive pleasure from that, and pleasure is the ultimate good? Now, just like they won't tell you you're wrong. You can't live that way. You can't live that way because of the relativism, and you can't live that way because we all know, everybody knows, that there are things that are absolutely morally right, and we all know that there are things that are absolutely morally wrong. Independent of anything we feel, any pleasure, any school, anything we've been taught, we all know when something's right and something's wrong. And you look at history, and you can't deny that morality, a standard of morality has always existed, that transcends personal preferences. Thou shalt not kill. God gave that commandment to Moses, but before he ever gave that to Moses, it was already wrong to kill. And man knew that it was wrong to kill. When was killed by Cain, when Cain killed Abel, there were no Ten Commandments yet. Moses wasn't even born yet. But what Cain did was wrong. And Cain knew that it was wrong because he hid his brother's body. And when God asked him, where's your brother? He denied, I don't know anything. What am I, my brother's keeper? Why is he hiding it if it's not wrong? He could have said, hey, God, yeah, his skull is broken. He's right there in the field. I just hit him over the head with a rock. No, he didn't do that, because he knew it was wrong. Because morality is written in our hearts by God. He made us in his image. So his morality is deep-seated in our hearts. So we know that hedonism is not the right thing to do. But the problem is that pleasure overrides what we know. And that's not outlandish. I'm not stretching it here. People do wrong things knowing it is wrong because they want the pleasure. The pleasure it brings overrides their knowledge of something being wrong. And you see that in every sin that people engage in. Then you have syncretism. Oh man, that idea is floating around alive and well. I travel a lot in the airports. You see it. Now in the airports, you know that all the airports have a church. Not really a church, a prayer room. All the airports have one. And you know what? You walk in there, and you walked into a syncretist church. All the religions are represented. And you'll be in Miami International, and you're waiting for a flight, and you hear them say, a Muslim service will be held in the prayer room at 7:30. You are all invited. And if you're waiting long enough, you'll hear another announcement in a little while say, a Christian service will be held in the prayer room at 10 o'clock. It's like, it doesn't matter. All the religions are the same. Syncretism is the idea that all the religions are the same. They're all equally valid. Everybody's got the truth. We just got to look at it different ways. And I'm sure you've heard that. You know, all the roads lead to Rome, and all the religions pursue the same God in different ways. Except it sounds great, but it's not true. It is not true, and we've gone over that before. We've seen that. It's not true. It doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Well, how can they all be the same? A Hindu believes in millions of gods, literally millions of gods, not thousands, not hundreds of thousands, millions of deities, which, by the way, all showed up after the world was already created. They don't have an explanation for the origin of the universe. The world was already existing when these deities showed up, millions of them. But then you turn around to a Buddhist, and a Buddhist is an atheist. Buddhists don't believe in any god. So wait a minute, how could they be the same? How could you say they're both the same? Both roads lead to Rome. What's Rome? For a Buddhist, Rome is non-existence. Nirvana, ceasing to exist. For the Hindu, it's something like that, but there's all these gods that get you there and that intervene with your life. And then you turn around to the Muslim, and the Muslim believes in God, but it's only one God. It's not 10 million gods. It's one God. And by the way, he's not a Trinity to the Muslims. But the Christian says, no, God is a Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So how can somebody stand and say they're all the same? Are you kidding me? What is it, God or no God? You can't have them both. What is it, 10 million gods or one God? You can't have them both. Is God a Trinity or not a Trinity? You can't have them both. All of these internal inconsistencies and contradictions tells you that you can't have this worldview. This worldview doesn't work. It's fatally flawed. Sounds good. Now, should we all be tolerant of people? Of course we should. Of course we should. You should treat a Muslim the same way you treat a Hindu, the same way you treat a Christian. We should be tolerant of each other. Absolutely. God tells us to love our neighbors. He doesn't say only our Christian neighbors. We love all of our neighbors. And if you want to be a Muslim, you have every right to be a Muslim. And if you want to be a Hindu, you have every right to be a Hindu. And if you want to be an atheist, you have every right to be an atheist. Tolerance is not what we're talking about. The Bible advocates tolerance. What we're talking about with syncretism is the idea that all of these views are equally valid and they're all the same and they're all right. Which is obviously, obviously not the case. Then you have pragmatism. This idea is abounding in the world we live in. You might call it materialism as well. Materialism in the monetary sense of the way, not in matter and naturalism. The ultimate good is whatever's the most productive. It's all about the bottom line. Whatever it takes to keep that bottom line in the black, whatever it takes to make a profit, whatever is most profitable, that's what we want. Everything is governed by that. And it's interesting because I'll never forget a conversation I had a long time ago when I was a college freshman. I walked into Miami-Dade College, and I remember having this conversation with a friend of mine. Well, we were getting to know each other from India, an Indian guy. And he and I were talking, and he asked me and a couple of guys that were together, why are you in college? What was the common answer that we all gave? Well, I want to study this. You know, and I'm here to become this or become that. And then the follow-up question was, and why do you want to become that? Well, because it makes a lot of money. We're all going to college to get a degree so we can get a job that makes a lot of money. That was all of our mentality. But it wasn't his. He says, wow, it's different in my country. He says, we go to college because we want to be better people. Because we want to know. We have knowledge makes us better people. And I'll never forget that. I was a college freshman, and it was ingrained in my head because it made sense. Made sense. Our perspective in this world, our Western world mentality is all about the money. All about the money. I had, as a teacher for many years, I would have these conversations with my high school seniors when we got to the whole problem of ethics and we would start talking about these things. And it never ceased to amaze me the number of ladies in my classes that would readily admit without any hesitation and without any embarrassment that they would rather marry somebody who was rich than marry somebody who they were in love with. They wanted to marry for the money. And there was no, It was no question. I mean, and it wasn't even considered something to be ashamed of. No. I won't even date a guy unless he's got this and this and this and that and the other thing. And marry somebody? I'm not going to marry somebody unless they have a lot of money. And you know what? Where do they learn these things? At home. In our culture. The pursuit of riches and pragmatism is that. But there's an ugly side to pragmatism. A very ugly side to pragmatism. And that is, in order to make things productive, you run over whoever you have to run over, and you kill whoever you have to kill, and you eliminate whoever you have to eliminate. Because as long as it's productive. So what if we have to have child labor? Child labor makes cheap products, and we make a better profit. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with the exploitation of children in factories? So, I mean, it's more productive. Why pay somebody a wage here when you can have the work done in Mexico or in Honduras for a fraction of the price? Who cares if we have unemployment here? I'm making a profit. Pragmatism. It's the idea that Social Security? No. You contribute to society, and when you come to that age where you can no longer contribute to society and you become a liability and expense to society, we put you down like a dog. Give you a nice little injection and goodbye. You don't cost us any more money, and that's the most pragmatic way to deal with life. Why spend $1 million with somebody in hospital bills who's never going to produce another cent for you? No. Your productive years are over. See ya. It's called euthanasia. It's the idea that, you know, whatever is productive, pragmatism has a very ugly side. Everything's good if you're on the right side of that. Once you step across the line to the other side, it's not so pretty. It's not so. And by the way, from a Christian perspective, what can you take with you? Jesus was so good with this. In that parable, he talks about that rich man, and that rich man had stored all these warehouses full of stuff, of grain. And he said, "You fool, we're coming for your soul tonight. And what are you going to take with you?" So much for your pragmatism. You built bigger storehouses so you can store more grains. Whoop-wee. Wow, great, awesome. You're dying tonight. How much of those grains can you take with you? What does Jesus say? Jesus says, store up your treasures in heaven, where nobody can take it from you, and it's going to be there eternally for you. The things of this world, they pass. So pragmatism, again, is competing for the minds of young people, but it doesn't work. Then you have existentialism. Existentialism is that depressing idea that there is no purpose to life. We make our own purpose. There is no purpose to life. We make our own purpose. Jean-Paul Sartre, you know, was a notorious atheist existentialist, and his idea was that there is no purpose to life. Here's his direct quote, if I'm not mistaken. There is no purpose to life the moment you lose the illusion of God. Once you realize that there's no God, there's no purpose to life. Make your own purpose. We just exist. We're an accident. We should never have been here. If things happened again, we would not be here. Guaranteed it would not have happened. And what is this life about? Whatever you want to make it about. Because when you die, it's all over. It's very depressing. Incredibly depressing view. But a lot of people are sold that idea and are taken captive by that idea. No purpose. There's no purpose of life. You don't even seek a purpose. What's the point? You make your own purpose. What do you want your purpose to be in life? You want to marry somebody successful and live happily ever after? That's your purpose? Go for it. What's your purpose? You know, find a way of making a living without having to work? Well, go for it. Stealing, whatever. I mean, it doesn't matter. You decide your own purpose. And then you have postmodernism, which is the worst. There is no absolute truth. Redefining everything, redefining truth, redefining everything. And we don't have time to really elaborate on this. But the most damaging component of postmodernism is the idea that there is no truth. There is no truth with a capital T. It's all our truth. We make up our own truth as we go along. Whatever's true for you, true for me. It doesn't have to be true for me. It could be true for you. Whatever. Who cares? And that applies across the board. At FIU, there's a very famous literature professor who is a postmodernist, who when he teaches his literature classes, he'll tell you that there's no meaning in the text. You give it the meaning, whatever it means to you. And he's written books on this, which I find ironic. Think about that for a minute, okay? If there's no meaning in the text, then why should I read your book? Right? There's no meaning in the text except in your text. In that one, there's meaning. I'm supposed to read that one and follow what it says, right? See, it's completely contradictory. The idea that you decide whatever it is. You read a novel and it means whatever you want it to mean to you, and there's no wrong answer. Really? You can't discover what an author intended to convey? How does that work? There's a whole theory behind it. And interestingly, it's all written down for you to read. Which world would I choose? Let's wrap this up. Personal integrity means that we or should guide us or should provoke us to compare, to contrast, to analyze, to see what am I going to believe? Which idea should I take as mine? And I think the best way to approach this is look at life's ultimate questions. There's four questions that we've always had in society as long as man has been around. Where did we come from? What has gone wrong? How can we fix it? And what happens when we die? Everybody asks those questions. So which worldview answers them better? I think that's a great way of testing. Which worldview has the best answer to those four questions? Origins, morality, you know, purpose and destiny. How do we answer these questions? Okay, so let's take the predominant worldview, naturalism, that we started off with. And how does they answer that question? Where did we come from? Well, we're a result of a cosmic accident. It's called the Big Bang Theory. 12 to 14 billion years ago, the universe was, as we know, it was reduced to a tiny, dense singularity, no larger than a dime. That exploded, and boom. 14 billion years later, we're here. A cosmic accident. We weren't meant to be here. Had that explosion never happened, we wouldn't be here. Had that explosion hadn't happened the way it happened, and we got so lucky that there was one rock that started orbiting the sun, which was another rock that was really hot and, you know, made as a star to produce heat, and all of these lucky things, and we fell into orbit with it, and then somehow we got water. They don't know how water got here. Maybe there were glacier, you know, ice meteoroids hit our Earth. That's one theory how we got water on the planet. You know, you wonder where they came from because explosions don't produce ice. You know, there's all. Is that a satisfying answer? We all came from a nothing, from an explosion? And by the way, the modern theory is that nothing exploded. Literally. Nothing was what exploded. Because nothing is unstable. We already had that talk. Okay. So, what has gone wrong? Why is society so messed up? That's another question everybody asks. You turn on the news and you hear all these horrible stories about all these horrible things. How do we get so messed up? Why is society so messed up? What's gone wrong? Well, the naturalist perspective is this. It's an external problem. Man is good by nature but has been corrupted by society. So guess how we fix it? You fix society. You fix society, it stops corrupting men, and you stop having all of these problems. It's called utopianism. That's the idea. So a naturalist worldview will tell you, okay, you know why things are so messed up? Because society corrupts people. We're good by nature, but society corrupts us. And then, how do you fix it? You fix society. And if you don't believe me, just take a step back. Okay, every time somebody commits a crime, it's not their fault. It's society's fault. It was that violent movie made me do it. If there weren't so many violent movies, people wouldn't be killing other people. Why did he rape that girl? Well, pornography. If there wasn't so much pornography to watch, he wouldn't be raping people. It's always somebody else's fault. It's society's fault. So fix society and you do away with the problems. That's the mentality. That's the idea. Now, let's think about that for a minute. There's one question that I think destroys the entire argument. The entire argument. And you know what the question is? Define society for me. What is society? Society is the people. So wait a minute. Good people form a good society because good people are good. So how society made up of good people corrupt good people? How does that work? It doesn't work. If society is evil, then what is society? It's people. So you can't tell me people are good and people are evil. And society corrupt. No, you can. You can't have it both ways. It's either one way or the other. So it totally falls apart when you consider it, when you stop and think about it. We are not good by nature. That's the problem. What happens when we die? Well, nothing. It's the end of our existence. As Richard Dawkins says, we join the dust of the cosmos. We become cosmic dust particles. So that's what we're all destined to. For my part, I want to contribute as much dust as possible. Yeah, so, amen. So we want to contribute as much dust as possible to the cosmos. But that's the mentality. It's all over when you die. It's all over when you finish. Okay? So how does that compare to the Christian response to these questions? How does that compare to the Christian worldview? Okay? Where did we come from? Well, we're not a cosmic accident. We are the masterpiece of a great designer. We are a special creation of the God who created the universe. So that's where we come from. Now, is that wishful thinking? Is that wishful thinking? Is there any evidence to support that? There's a ton of evidence. If you were here 2 weeks ago, I did a talk called The Fingerprints of God, Intelligent Design, that shows you that the evidence that we are designed are overwhelming. It's impossible to believe that we were not designed. Impossible. The statistics are impossible. You remember the video on the sand? It's impossible to believe that we are the product of random chance. No, we are designed. So the Christian response, the Christian worldview response is far more evidence-based, reasonable, and rational than to believe that all of the order we see came about by accident, unguided by any intelligence. So, okay, God made us. That still doesn't fix the problem. What's gone wrong? God made us. Okay, good. We're the masterpiece of an incredible God. So why have things gone wrong? Why is everything so messed up? Okay, then to us, it's not an external problem. It's an internal problem. For us, it's not about society. Creation was damaged by sin. Creation was damaged by sin. The problem is not in society. The problem is in my heart. When somebody commits a crime, it's not society that made him do it. It's in the heart. The problem is in the heart. Society can influence you, but society can't make you do anything. There's no connection between seeing 50 hours of pornography and going out and raping somebody. The TV program cannot make you rape somebody. It could give you ideas, but your heart has to be corrupt to the point where you would rape somebody. Take it to that next level. Watching a violent movie. I love violent movies, and I've never killed anybody. I love movies. If there aren't 10 dead people in the first 2 minutes of the movie, I don't want to watch it. It's boring. And that's been what I've done all my life. When I grew up, there was a movie theater called the Circle Theater there in Miami Springs in the Circle, and they would give double features. You would come in and see two movies for the price of one. So my dad and I would go in there and see two Bruce Lee movies, one right after the other. What? Plus our cartoon in between that were really good, those cartoons too. So you know how we walk out of that movie after watching two Bruce Lee movies? I would be kicking fences and all. You know, I thought I was Bruce Lee. And I wasn't. If you've seen that little video on Facebook of the two kids fighting Taekwondo, have you guys seen it? It's hilarious. And they never touch each other. One kid goes like this and the other kid goes. And they're all dressed up. And that's how I imagine I looked when we left those movies and tried to imitate. But anyway, in my mind, my legs were flying, and I was whoosh. But here's the deal. The problem is in the heart. Sin is the problem. It's not an external. It's not the movies you watch, although they could damage you. It's a sin. It's in the heart. It's an internal problem. So how do we fix it? We don't have to fix society. You're never going to fix society until you fix the heart of people. So we have to talk about regeneration. We need to build culture based on truth. Restore values to the heart of man. That's what's going to change society. In a society where people live, really live the Christian life, what social problems are you going to have? Zero. People die. You have orphans. You have widows. What is the Christian going to do? Support them. Help them. Feed them. Is there going to be any rape going on? No, the Bible forbids it. We're going to live a Christian morality. That's not going to happen. Is there going to be murder? No, the Bible forbids it. We're going to live a Christian lifestyle. We're not going to do that. Is there going to be stealing going on? No, people are going to be honest because they're living a Christian lifestyle. They're honest. And if they're honest, there's no stealing, no cheating, no none of that. So you start adding these things up. So what would fix society if people lived the godly life? That only happens when people are regenerated, when they get a new heart. What happens when we die? Well, man faces his creator and is given a permanent dwelling with or without God. We're given our permanent dwelling with or without God. That's why I agree with C.S. Lewis. I believe Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because of it, I see everything else. One of my favorite C.S. Lewis quotes. Everything makes sense when you have the clear lenses on. And when you start answering these questions with a clear lens, it makes sense. All the other answers just don't satisfy. They come up short. They don't work. The heart of our worldview is Jesus Christ. I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but by me. That's the heart of the Christian worldview. It is God's mind that we want. It is Jesus' mind that we want. I'll finish with two quotes. Even people who are not Christian admit this. When you have hostile witnesses testifying on your behalf, that's a very powerful argument. Take this one, for example, from Lecky, which was an atheist historian. The character of Jesus has been not only the highest pattern of virtue, but the strongest incentive to its practice, and has exercised so deep an influence that it may truly be said that the simple record of 3 short years of active life has done more to regenerate and soften mankind than all the disquisition of the philosophers and all the exhortations of the moralists. Just 3 years on this earth, and Jesus revolutionized human history and has done more for human history than all of the moralist philosophers and people arguing throughout all of history in just 3 years of ministry. And that's from an atheist, okay, who's being honest. Here's another quote from an agnostic, Will Durant, that a few simple men like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John should in one generation have invented so powerful and appealing a personality, Jesus, so lofty an ethic, Christianity, and so inspiring a vision of human brotherhood, the church, would be a miracle far more incredible than any recorded in the Gospels. To say that this was a human invention would be impossible. It would be a miracle bigger than any of the miracles in the Gospels. And this is an agnostic telling you. There's supernatural behind this. God is behind this. And even the agnostic will acknowledge that. So in conclusion, the greatest question of our time, Will Durant, who we just read, says is not communism versus individualism, nor Europe versus America, nor even the East versus the West. It's whether man can live without God. That was the question he says. He says that's the greatest question of our time. Can man live without God? I think he was wrong. I think the greatest question is, if Christianity is so consistent and so faithful to the truth, what we should ask is why man would want to live without God. That's the question. Why would man want to live without God if he's the one that makes sense of all of reality to us? So when you have these conflicting worldviews, please don't lose sight of Colossians 2:8. See to it that no one takes you captive with these hollow and deceptive philosophies. We're in a discotheque here. I'm going to start dancing. The lights are getting interesting here. You don't want to see me dance. Trust me. I don't want to see me dance. But anyway, right? Anyway, so those lights really threw me off there. Kung fu dancing, right? Anyway, back to Colossians, okay? See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophies. We got to be better than that. We got to know the truth. We have to have the mind of Christ and not let ourselves be taken captive by these ideas. This is all based on human traditions and the basic knowledge of this world rather than on Christ. That's the mindset we need to have. We see everything through our minds. That's why it's important to have the mind of Christ when we see things. Let's stand up tonight.